So just to be clear, to begin with, about the location of Benin, the kingdom of Benin is not in the was not located in the nation state of what's now Benin, but was to the south and east of Lagos in southern Nigeria. It seems to have risen in the 13th century. That's according to the oral sources we have from the kingdom of Benin. It was in the 13th century that it began to rise particularly to prominence, but it particularly grew from the 1450s onwards under the king or Oba Eware, who strengthened town chiefs and the ruling dynasty. So the question arises, of course, why was it particularly in around the 1450s that Benin came to prominence? So we know, for example, when the Portuguese arrived in 1480s, there's a trading town near the coast called Huaton, and the capital city at Edo has got large city walls and is a major structure. So how did it arisen? I think it was connected to a whole range of wider changes in West Africa in the 15th century. We know that in other parts of southern Nigeria, there were large earthworks, walls, city walls built in this period, the eredos as they're known. But we also know that the 15th century in West Africa did see the rise of various different ethnicities and peoples and kingdoms. So Mossi in what's now Burkina Faso, Songhai, the Empire of Songhai, Kano's power particularly came to prominence in the 15th century. This was a period which did see, for various reasons, the coalescence and the growth of political power in different parts of West Africa. I think there are various different reasons for this. One of them was that the growth of the trans-Saharan trade, the increasing production of gold, and the interchange with cities like Kano, with the Songhai Empire in those areas which had connection to the trans-Saharan trade, then saw increasing trade between those regions and the areas nearer to the coast. So a wider trading structure across West Africa as a whole was connected to the consolidation of larger political structures, and this may have been one of the factors leading to the powerful rise of Benin. At the same time, there were lots of structures from within Benin, the growth of the aristocracy, the rise of an army, the ability to develop labour structures which would facilitate the building of city walls, for example, which also shows that Benin itself was growing in power and that forces local to Benin helped to shape that. So Benin developed with initially a central power structure emerging around the figure of the Oba, the king, who was both a political figure and a figure of enormous religious power. The creation of new shrines was very important. So, for example, the Oba I've mentioned, Eware, in one of the things he did was to develop important new shrines. And so political power around the Oba and the aristocracy grew at the capital, at Edo, saw the building of city walls. So those reached a height of around 20 metres in some places, covered an area of 7.5 square kilometres, which is actually only a small fraction of the urban complex of wider Benin. And by the 17th century, these city walls had gates of 8 or 9 feet in height, according to some witnesses. Beyond that, there was a very powerful army in Benin. Military power was important. In the 16th century, Benin expanded in various directions. And beyond that military structure, there was also a religious structure was also very important. So the Oba of Benin, on being appointed, would always send a gift to the Oni of Ife, who was the religious figurehead at the heart of what became the Oyo Empire, which was the largest Yoruba empire in southern Nigeria. So there was an important spiritual connection between the Oba of Benin and Ile Ife, the heartland, spiritual heartland of Yoruba cultures. So those political, religious, and military frameworks were very important in the rise of Benin. Well, so he was, as I've mentioned, the king of Benin, but he was, as I was also, he was a religious and a spiritual figurehead as well. And this was manifested in various different ways. Very few people were allowed to see him or speak to him. Nobody could eat with him. So there were sort of what's known as sumptuary laws around his figure, his personality. And that consecrated, in many ways, the divinity of the power of his power of ruling. Now, of course, that's not just the case in Benin. We know, of course, of the concept of divine right for European kings. We know that among the Aztecs, for example, at the same time, Moctezuma was also seen as being a divine figure as well. So the divinity of ruling is not something which is limited to Benin, but it certainly was a very important part of the Oba's figure. And these sumptuary laws also shaped very much how people saw him. And by the start of the 17th century, the Oba actually only left the palace compound in Edo twice a year for two different religious festivals and ceremonies. One of the consequences of that, of course, was, given that he was largely actually confined to the palace compound, was that the palace compound itself became more and more physically impressive and imposing and important. So a late 17th century description describes, and I'll quote this, he said, "The king's court is square and stands at the right-hand side when entering the town. It certainly is large as the town of Haarlem in the Netherlands. It's divided into many magnificent palaces, houses, and apartments of the courtiers, comprises beautiful and long square galleries, about as large as to the Exchange at Amsterdam, one larger than another, resting on wooden pillars from top to bottom, covered with cast copper, on which are engraved the pictures of war exploits of battles, which are kept very clean. Those are, of course, the famous Benin bronzes. So we can see that the palace was a manifestation. Its brilliant, its imposing nature was a manifestation of the Oba's political and religious power. Well, fundamental to this was, of course, the rise of warfare. And as I've mentioned, at the start of the 16th century, Benin began to expand rapidly. It was actually the duty of the Oba to declare war. And in the 16th century, Benin expanded up to what's now Lagos. By the end of this century, however, the 16th century, that duty to declare war had devolved from the Oba to high-ranking military officers, much as was the case, in fact, in Europe at that time, where it had been the duty of kings to lead their troops into battle, and that began to change in this same period. The army was huge. By the 17th century, we have one report of the army of Benin reaching to 20,000 people, and there was a reserve of up to 80 or 100,000 in times of need, which is really a large army. The commander of the field in the field was known as the Oweyaseri, and they had supreme power in the battle, but also there were also nobles and commoners who also fought in campaigns which one source describes involved the waging of great wars against neighbouring kings beyond Benin to the east and north, both conquering the towns and villages and also, of course, gaining booty. So the system developed from one in which warfare was a royal duty related to the person of the Oba to one it really became an integral part of the state, which is, of course, very analogous to the place of warfare in early modern Europe. Yes, I think it's interesting to see how that evolved from the 15th to the 18th century. And one of the things that evolved during that time was the increased availability of the money supply. One of the main currencies, the main currency used in Benin was the cowry, and the import of cowries expanded hugely at this time with the Atlantic trade. This meant, of course, that there was more money available, more taxation, and the state could grow. And the political structure of Benin began to shift as a result. So by the 18th century, you actually had a ruling council where 60 people, 20 dealt with receipts and expenses, 20 dealt with trade, 20 dealt with war. So by that time, there's, you know, almost like we might say a kind of cabinet government in place in Benin, which has emerged as a sort of structure of governing the Benin Empire. So that's something which grows, its administrative machinery grows as the kingdom grows, as warfare grows, as I mentioned, it becomes institutionalised really within Benin. Those structures also grow, and there are many different officials which emerge. As I mentioned, the palace compound becomes much more important in this period, much bigger and more impressive, and many different officials present in the palace compound. So, for example, the Iwebo were in charge of the Oba's regalia of state, like his throne, his ceremonial wardrobe. The Iwegune looked after his private apartments and arranged private audiences if there were to be some. So there were lots of different positions which emerged with this increasing machinery and which helped to essentially govern the imperial structure of Benin. The bronzes are the most famous product, really, of Benin. And as I've mentioned, we actually have the 17th century accounts which tell us that the palace was covered with them. And that they were, and one of the interesting things about those accounts is that they describe how they were essentially histories. They were histories of the different Obas, of their achievements, of the wars which they had fought. Some of them also describe the relationships which the Obas had developed with the Portuguese. You find representations of Portuguese traders in those bronzes. They also, I think, in many ways, what's important about the bronzes is that they also help to understand the transformation of identities and subjectivities which was taking place at this time. They are artistic representations of Benin's view of itself, Benin's view of the importance of the Obas and their power, but also Benin's view of the importance of the relationship with outsiders as this began to influence the way in which Benin was evolving. So it's a form of preservation of the past and of a perspective which you simply can't really otherwise find for this period of history. At the same time, I think the other important thing, thinking about Benin's bronzes, is how they also, in many ways, embody the colonial history of African kingdoms such as Benin and their relationship with European powers, how the bronzes were essentially stolen from Benin with the arrival of the English in 1897 and the sacking of the palace, distributed around various different European museums, assumed initially by European art historians that they were so magnificent they couldn't have been produced by the people of Benin themselves. They must have been produced in collaboration with Portuguese craftsmen. And then gradually, over the course of the last 100 years, the realisation that actually there's a much more complex, fascinating and important story to be told for them. So in many ways, they embody colonial relationships as well. One of the important things about studying Benin is that Benin is an example of a kingdom which after initial contact with the Portuguese, participation in the slave trade for about 30 or 40 years, in the 1530s, refused all further participation in the slave trade with the Portuguese and maintained that position for almost two centuries. From the 1530s onwards, the main export of Benin were locally made cloths known as ambastis, and that remained the case through to the 1680s. In the 1680s, we have a lot of documents which describe how the value of these ambassies, the price, their worth, the demand for them fell through the floor. This was for a number of complex reasons. A lot of it was to do with competition from other cloths which were being imported by European traders from Europe and also from India. And what this meant was that Benin could no longer maintain its economic base through the trading systems which had developed over the previous 200 years. If it wanted to maintain that trade, it had to shift and participate in the slave trade. So in the 18th century, that's what happened. Obas of Benin re-engaged with the slave trade after a gap of 170 years. And in fact, the kingdom did become more important towards the late 18th century and remained powerful force in the region through the 19th century. In the 19th century, though, what you have is the beginnings of formal colonial occupation and power, the scramble for Africa. That's related to technological changes, the rise of the steamship, and also the complete collapse in value of currencies in West Africa, such as the Cowrie currency, hyperinflation, which took place in the second half of the 19th century. All this means that a kingdom like Benin can no longer resist British colonial power when they arrive in 1897. Well, very much, I think, in various ways. I mean, one of the ways in which it does, I think, is in debates which are more and more potent as we speak on the question of museums around the world and the location of, for example, the Benin bronzes and the demands for restitution, which are becoming increasingly powerful, and various museums in Benin City in Nigeria participating in those dialogues. So it's very symbolic, as I've mentioned, of colonial history and of the desire now to move beyond that, and part of that would involve the restitution of pieces like the Benin bronzes. So that's an important part, I think, of the legacy and significance of Benin. I think the other thing that can be said about Benin is that it is an example, I think, in history of a kingdom which, as I've mentioned, refused to have any participation in the slave trade. So there is a strain in historiography which talks about Africans participating and selling other Africans. And looking at the history of Benin gives a completely different perspective on that and shows that really it's only when external forces become magnified to an extent that the kingdom can no longer survive and not participate in the slave trade, that it re-engages with it in the 18th century. So it helps to frame a different perspective on African history over a long period of time.